From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. A master has left us. Earlier this week, the French chef Joël Robuchon died of cancer at the age of 73. Robuchon was the most decorated chef in the world, amassing more than 30 Michelin stars during his lifetime. He was often called the chef of the century.
This food was very classical, you know, a lot about very classic French technique, but very, very simple, simplicity.
That's LA chef Ludo Lefebvre. He's been reflecting on his time with Robuchon as well as his far-reaching influence. Hi, Ludo.
Hello, how are you, Evan?
Did you grow up knowing the name Joël Robuchon?
Yes, I started cooking in the 80s, and already Joël Robuchon was a big name, definitely. That's for that I decided in 94 to go stage at Joël Robuchon.
Where had you been working before?
I was with Mr. Pierre Gagnère.
So what did you hope to get from Robuchon that you weren't getting at Gagnère?
Pierre Gagnère, you know, was a chef in the 90s, was really creative, breaking a little bit the rule, I would say, of French cuisine, using more spice. The plating was more like a Jackson Pollock painting. You know, the sauce was like splash on the plate. The different flavor, taking risk with new combination of flavor. Joël Robuchon was totally the opposite. It was more very classic, technical, you know, you put 16 dots of the sauce on the plate, not 17, 16, okay? He was counting the dots all the time.
I feel like the way you've described him, that things that you learned in his kitchen, you really took into your own culinary practice.
Ah oui, definitely. Huh? I mean, Joël Robuchon impacted me a lot as a young chef, you know, when I was cooking, you know. One of the greatest meisters. How to say, this generation start a different level of dining, definitely. Look what happened, you know, also with Paul Bocuse, you know, 1 month, 2 months or 3 months ago already, you know. Almost like make me feel like a responsibility to always respect the way of all for my teacher, you know. To respect their the discipline, you know. It was really like, Joël Robuchon was a lot about discipline. Heaven, you have no idea how the kitchen was like the army. It was insane. I never see a kitchen like that, never. The discipline, the rigor, the to make sure we have the best ingredients, make sure everything was perfect. If the mashed potatoes was not perfect, we do another one. We're always behind. We're always running to be ready for service. It was just so much pressure in this kitchen. The rigor, the discipline to be the best. It was just insane. I mean, you don't sleep the night when you walk over there. It was insane. You have no idea how many times the dot. Like, seriously, the dot. You have a little spoon of a coffee spoon and you put 16 dots of this watercress sauce, you know, and 14 of this mango sauce. I mean, what just you dream about that, you know, and at that time it was not squeeze bottle and all the dots need to be perfect. You have no idea. Joël Robuchon was like just one like that, you know. He was very known to be a very, very difficult kitchen.
Yes, I understand that he was an intimidator, a screamer, but the man himself, did you later on, after you came into your own as a chef with your own restaurants, did you have any interactions with him more recently where you sort of got to know him more as a man and less as the boss?
You know, I always know him more like a boss. I know it makes sense, but I was not very close with him. Like, you know, some chefs, I'm very close with them still. I was never really close with Joël Robuchon. Because I was just a line cook, I think.
Are there philosophies of running a kitchen that you use today because of him?
Oh, yeah. You know, yes, of course I use it. You know, it's really like a repetition. You know, it's every day is a new day. And we need to be better and consistent. You know, I learned with him how to be consistent in the kitchen. To be creative, it's easy. To create a dish, it's easy. But to be consistent is so, so difficult. And that's what I learned with Joël Robuchon, to be consistent. I mean, the cauliflower mousse, you know, with the caviar, you need to be all the time the same. The mashed potatoes, you know how many times I did the mashed potatoes over there, guys? You have no idea. Ugh. To pass the mashed potatoes in three different food meals and a spatula, and oh my God, and you need to be the same all the time. And I learned how to be a perfectionist over there. You know, it's just insane how we are just so consistent over there. Everybody have one job to do, and you do the same job all the time.
He was one of the first to have a global empire of restaurants. Did that have an impact on you when you were younger?
Not really. When I was younger, don't really have an impact on me. You know, I was not thinking to have an empire like him, definitely, you know. You know, what he did to have so many restaurants, and that's so fast, it was pretty amazing. You know, he get 3-star Michelin in 3 years, you know, and it never happened before, you know. You just have one guy like Joël Robuchon, but what he created is empire. I mean, I was surprised about that, you know. For me, how you can be consistent, you know, with an empire like that. Especially know him, to work with him. He was so about to be perfectionist, to be in the kitchen every day. And after, when you see he open the different restaurants, you know, to manage that, it was pretty impressive.
Did you ever go back and eat as a diner?
Never. Yeah, I have no idea. I was so traumatized to work over there, guys. In the good way. Over there, it was just so hard, guys. You know, it was just like so much pressure. But in the good way, you know. I mean, I was very, very proud to work over there. Very proud. But it was so hard. You know, so hard to work over there. It was like really like the army. Over there, you talk like the language in the army over there. You have the general, you have the admiral, the general. You know, you have the captain, the lieutenant. I mean, it was that over there. Everybody have a job to do, like in the army. And trust me, we are consistent over there. My job was to do 16 dots in the plate. To the teaspoon or coffee spoon, 16 dots. Not 15, 16.
When I think about Petit Trois on Highland, and I think about the classic food that you're making with a very casual environment, do you think you would have thought of doing that if the L'Atelier hadn't existed?
Very interesting, because you're right, because Joël Robuchon, talking about L'Atelier, Joël Robuchon was the first chef to really take this concept of Japanese restaurant and bring to France and to open the kitchen and to create this relationship, because he wanted to create the relationship between the cook and the customer. And you're right, I mean, I created Trois Mecs, definitely. It's really like L'Atelier, definitely. Yes, it was an inspiration of Joël Robuchon, of Yves Canderbord to L'Avant Comptoir. But you're right, Joël Robuchon was the first chef to really take the Japanese concept and to recreate in the French way.
Thank you so much, Ludo.
Merci, Evan. You know, don't forget 16 dots on the plate.
How can I ever forget? That's Chef Ludo Lefebvre, here to discuss the legacy of Joël Robuchon. Coming up, we revisit my 2014 road trip to Las Vegas when the late Jonathan Gold and I had the pleasure of dining at Joël Robuchon's restaurant there. Stick around.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. We've been remembering the French chef Joël Robuchon, who passed away this week. About 4 years ago, I took one of my favorite road trips ever. I spent a couple of days in Las Vegas with the late Jonathan Gold and my former producer Jillian Ferguson. The highlight was our dinner at Joël Robuchon's namesake restaurant at the MGM Grand. Up until that point, I'd never had such a luxurious meal. I'll always be grateful for the time that the great chef took to speak with me, with the help of a translator, of course. Take a listen. I'm sitting in the restaurant Joël Robuchon here in Las Vegas with the man himself, Chef Robuchon. And after having dined here last night, which was a spectacular experience, you know, I have to say that after having dined in such an
incredibly beautiful, quiet, curated way. And then having walked out into the casino floor, where all you're assaulted by sound, light, sort of very popular sounding PA system announcements, I said to myself, how did they convince him to come here? At the very beginning, when you first came here to visit, when you were in discussion to do the restaurant, did they walk you through the casino floor? Did you understand that you were going to have to recreate the kind of beauty and very particular experience that you offer in Paris and other parts of the world in a corner of such chaos?
Oui, alors on a essayé de faire, c'est vrai, un restaurant qui est assez quand même, c'est vrai.
It is true, when we first opened the restaurant, we did feel a little isolated, like we were on our own island in the corner here at the MGM, but at the beginning, we had very few customers. We had 3-4 customers in a night sometimes, so it was very difficult at the onset. But what makes me very satisfied now is that we have such a large repeat clientele. Very many of our guests, many of whom come from Los Angeles, actually will fly out or drive out just to have dinner with us and then go back home. And what we see now is that we are full almost every single night, which gives me a lot of satisfaction.
You have the restaurants in Paris. You have, this is the only location in the U.S. You have a location in Macau. Do you tailor the experience to the location?
Oui, j'essaie de tenir compte quand même des endroits.
Yes, of course. With regard to the location, the geographic location of where we are at any given point in time, we have to look for the locality of produce, and we have to keep that in mind when we're building the recipes in each individual location. We have, for example, here wonderful farms that are around this area from where we get wonderful potatoes. Sea urchin even is of wonderful quality out here. So whenever I look at building a recipe tailored to that specific location, I do first look at the produce that's available.
I wonder if you would share with us a memory. I find that people who grow up in the food business seem to be pushed forward by a primal memory, something maybe they experienced in childhood that they come back to over and over again in their mind regarding food.
D'abord, je vais vous surprendre. Il faut que vous sachiez comment je suis rentré en cuisine.
To begin with, I probably have to tell you that, and it may come as a surprise to you, but I actually began in a seminary when I was about 13 or 14 years old. And at that point in time, we had a lot of time spent where we were not allowed to speak. We had to stay in study or in prayer. And so for me, the nuns were always looking for people who were willing to help out in the kitchen and help cooking. And when I say cooking, I mean in the very basic sense. We were mostly peeling vegetables or washing dishes. But for me, that was relaxation time, where I was able to step away from this quiet time at the seminary. And as you know, nuns are very much spiritual. And from that memory and that upbringing, I take away an extreme respect for the produce that we have. When you look at what we cook with on a daily basis, in many times you have to take a life in order to cook or prepare a dish for someone. And so what I do is I have enormous respect for this life and for the produce which I'm allowed and enabled to work with. And I take that really from my memories.
Thank you so much.
Merci beaucoup.
That was the great French chef Joël Robuchon talking with me in 2014 at his Las Vegas restaurant by the same name. Like the fella once said. As I said before, dining at Joël Robuchon's Las Vegas restaurant a few years ago was a big first for me. I was there with Jonathan Gold, and I remember the shock on his face when I confessed that I had never eaten at a super refined palace of fine dining before. Here's our conversation from 2014 about our meal at Joël Robuchon. People may be surprised to hear it, but I have sort of held back from myself some of the peak culinary experiences that one would imagine that just as a matter of course, because I do what I do, I would have had several of. I'm talking about the very high-end, super uber culinary experience. But no, I have to say I was waiting to go with Jonathan and my lovely producer Jillian to Robuchon in Las Vegas. And even you, Jonathan, were shocked to learn that this was my first, like, sort of masterful culinary degustation experience.
You were chef for so long. I mean, I thought it inevitable that you would have ended up at Taille Avant in Paris, or at least, you know, a place like, you know, Danielle in New York.
I've leaned more towards the lower end of the scale. So for me, this experience was quite something. The fact that such a palace of dining exists in the corner of a casino, I still find unbelievably odd.
It's in the MGM, which is a very nice casino, but it's not what you think of as the opulent one. And you walk past all these slot machines with, like, pictures of Michael Jackson on them or fireballs or, you know, the usual kind of stuff. And then there's Robuchon.
Yeah, I mean, also, it's not a small casino. It's like being in a village. So basically, you enter the MGM Grand and you basically have to walk like the equivalent of a quarter mile, probably.
I'm not sure if it is now, but there was a point where that was the biggest hotel in the world.
Yeah, really huge. And then you basically walk to the very, very, very far corner, and there is the restaurant, Joël Robuchon. We should say that we didn't eat at the Atelier. We ate at the more sort of restaurant.
I like the Atelier. I mean, I've been to the one in Paris several times, and even from the first time I ate there probably a dozen years ago, you realized that it was going to be the future of fine dining in the world, that in a way the world of small plates restaurants comes from what he was doing there. The idea that because the food was formal and exquisite didn't mean that the service had to be. But you might as well go the whole nine. And I'd had one of the just most glorious meals of my life at the Robuchon restaurant called Germain, which is, I think, his first three-star restaurant in Paris. It was – Ruth Dreischel paid for it. It was the, you know, honeymoon gift for my wife, Lori, and I.
A pretty, pretty great, wonderful gift.
It was really good. That was a tough reservation to get.
So 30 years later, nearly –
right.
We find ourselves in the corner of this casino, seated on tufted purple velvet couches. How did it match up to the one you had in Paris?
Everything is more formalized here, and everything is sort of larger than life. There wasn't that sort of improvisatory idea that they're making it up as they go along. But of course, luxury is never quite like that, is it?
No. And I mean, for me, the experience, it was almost in two parts. There's the food, and then there's the space. And from the minute you walk in, it's clear that you are being transported to a place of fantastic luxury.
Right. You would think there would be this thing of decompression from the casino, but there isn't. You're sort of in the casino, and then boom, you're in this room with the plushness and with the soft classical music and with the people dressed up in a way that they never are anywhere else in Las Vegas. And with the sort of service that you just don't see anymore. It's not the, hey, Mac, it's not the beautiful woman. It's the French waiter who's been doing this clearly for his entire working life, who knows more about food and wine than anybody you've ever met, who is there to make you comfortable.
Yeah, and I was actually pretty surprised at how playful the service staff were at times.
They were trying really hard not to be intimidating, which is hard at a place like that.
Definitely. I mean, from the minute they wheel over the bread cart, maybe we could start there. Maybe you could describe the bread cart.
Well, first off, there is a bread cart. Secondly, the bread cart is just incredibly elaborate, this big sort of wooden thing with – it must have been 20 different kinds of breads. But I think what impressed all of us the most was when they brought out the butter. And they brought out the butter. It was like this giant Corinthian column of butter.
Yeah, it was a separate butter cart. Well, the butter and olive oil cart.
Yeah. And they carved off these beautiful thick curls of it.
And it was Brittany butter.
Yes, it was extremely good butter. I think actually any of us would have been happy to have just had bread and butter and skipped the rest of the meal. But of course, we weren't going to skip the rest of the meal because there were many, many courses to come.
How many courses were there?
I'm not remembering. There may have technically have been 15, though a lot of them were served to us in flights. So that there was a – and this was different for you because you got the vegetarian menu. But there was like a flight of crustaceans, which included, you know, his famous langoustine ravioli with truffles. There was a little dish of sea urchin on mashed potatoes. But what mashed potatoes those were. One of the things I also noticed at Robuchon, which is something that – I haven't seen in American menus in a really long time, is the sort of emphasis on super luxury ingredients. I mean, it's, you know, there was foie gras in four or five courses. There was caviar in at least four or five courses. There was gold leaf on things. There were langoustines, which are, you know, one of those top French ingredients. And there were truffles. I mean, literally paving that tart, you know, shaved over things like most places shave Parmesan.
I mean, I quickly realized in my choice to have chosen the vegetarian
right.
option was that I was trading the caviar, the langoustines, and the foie gras for truffle.
Yeah, you got double truffles on everything.
Yeah, it was pretty extraordinary. Was the quality of the experience similar to what you experienced in Paris all those years ago?
I would say the food was extraordinarily detailed and really well, you know, plated and served. It doesn't knock my memory of that out. But, you know, that was in 1990, and there have been a lot of meals under the bridge since then. And sometimes you wonder if, like, some of the extraordinary meals that one experiences as like a younger person are so vivid because, you know, it's the fourth four-star meal you've ever had. I mean, when I went to, you know, Michel Gérard for the first time, you know, I'd hitchhiked across France to get there. And it had better have been good, right? I mean, I'd been saving up for it for a year, whereas you know, this one, you're in a hotel, it's like, oh, what the hell, let's go to this restaurant. You make the reservation, and you're there, and suddenly you're just in the middle of this thing.
I felt like we were in an island on an island.
That makes sense, because one of my problems with Las Vegas cuisine is that there's sort of no there-ness to it. I mean, nothing reflects the terroir of Las Vegas, because there is no terroir of Las Vegas, right? Nothing grows there. It has, in a certain respect, become the luxury restaurant district for Los Angeles, that in the way that if you want to eat a certain kind of food in New York, you know, to eat Thomas Keller food or to eat the extraordinary food of, you know, Masa Takeyama, that you go to the Time Warner Mall and you take the elevator up six floors and suddenly you're in Per Se. And Las Vegas is almost like that, right? You get in your car, and 3 hours later, you're in Las Vegas where you're eating at Robuchon.
Really fascinating. A fascinating experience. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Gold talking to me in 2014 about our visit to Joël Robuchon's namesake restaurant in the MGM Grand. Visit the Good Food blog for my full account of the experience. That's blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, restaurant lines. You've seen them snaking around buildings all around LA. Why are some diners willing to wait up to 2 hours or more for a meal? We sent reporter Jean Trin to find out. Stay with us. It's Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Here's an increasingly common sight in LA. A new brunch spot opens up a couple blocks away. Pretty soon, the waiting area starts to fill up. One day, it spills out the door and a line begins to form down the sidewalk. You see these people as you drive by. Perhaps you even think they're suckers because you know of a place where there's no wait that's almost as good. However you feel about lines, it's clear that a growing number of Angelenos are willing to wait for their meal. Good Food contributor Jean Trin recently visited a few of the busiest places in town. She wanted to find out what keeps people coming back and what restaurant owners are doing to deal with the line. Thank you so much for waiting in line so we didn't have to.
Just doing the work for everyone.
What were the restaurants that you visited?
I visited three places. One was Squirrel, which is a breakfast and lunch spot in Silver Lake. You know, you can get really vibrant and nourishing dishes and that are market-driven and, you know, are creative and unique for breakfast. I also went to Ding Tai Fung, the Santa Anita Mall location, where it's known for xiaolongbao or, you know, the pork soup dumplings. And I also went to Howlin' Ray's, which does the Nashville hot chicken in Chinatown's Far East Plaza, and they've been open since 2016.
And each of these places that you mentioned, the line is intrinsic to the experience.
Yes, very much so. It's a whole experience where people are willing to wait, you know, anywhere from 30 minutes to hours.
So first, let's tackle Howlin' Ray's. Tell us about the particular day you went. Kind of set the scene for us.
I was at Howlin' Ray's on a Saturday morning, right when it opened at 10 a.m. And when I got there, there was already a huge line that was snaking from practically one end of the plaza to the other. And while you're standing in line, you could just smell this amazing fried chicken wafting. And people are very excited in line. They're chatting, especially when they're near the front of the line, you know, because they've waited so long. And once you get inside the restaurant, which is this really tiny space, you know, there's hip-hop music bumping, and there's this, like, frenetic energy inside with the staff and crew that work there. I've noticed that people usually come with a friend or with a group, and even if they've come alone, there's something that kind of happens pretty often where people end up making friends. And a couple of people I talked to that were super fans in line, you know, they go there a few times a week. Victoria Garcia and Daniel Zamorgan, they became friends. And now they call each other up to wait in line together.
Because you start talking to the people that are waiting in front of you as well as the people in back of you, and you start referring them with items to get for their first time, if it is their first time, or we'll start talking about stories and sharing Howlin' experiences where people just had the hottest one for their first time, even though that was a really, really bad idea.
You know, that morning when I went, people were telling me that they had already waited 2 hours in line. You know, they went even before the line opened, and that was like their strategy. And I remember over even Christmas break, people had waited 4 hours or 5 hours.
And it's not like it just opened yesterday.
No, it opened in 2016.
In visiting these restaurants, did you get any idea of how these places got so popular in the first place?
Sometimes media. For Squirrel, I spoke to the chef and owner, Jessica Coslow, about that moment when everything changed.
I would say that the lines really started to form after the Jonathan Gold review, which happened in December of 2012. That is just a couple of months after we opened, but it was fading. It was the line formed for a minute after his review. But the big jump for us happened the following year when there was a large editorial piece in Bon Appetit about the state of kind of a breakfast and lunch cafe, which was Squirrel, and it was 10 pages, and all of a sudden it was as if the ground shook, and it really hasn't stopped.
So Din Tai Fung, how did they get catapulted to this level of fame?
They already started off with some popularity after the New York Times came out with a story in 1993 naming them one of the top 10 best gourmet restaurants in the world. So they already had this huge following. So it was a big deal when the second generation owner, Frank Yang, opened the first U.S. location right here in Arcadia in the year 2000.
I remember that people are like, really, you're going to write about this and then we can't go?
Yeah. We're like, oh, I'm so sad about this.
So tons of pent-up demand.
You know, I spoke to his son, Albert Yang, about what it was like when his father opened that shop on that first day.
The lines have always been there. The lines were much larger than he expected. I heard that we had to close a day after our grand opening in 2000 since we couldn't keep up with the volume. But we opened after that day and had no issues since that. But it was much more than expected.
So food media really does make a difference. And I'm guessing that the food often does meet people's expectation and goes beyond, in fact.
Yes, the food is obviously really good. And, you know, I've been to these restaurants several times, and each time I go, the quality is consistent across the board. But what I found most interesting was the other stuff the restaurants do to entice their customers to come back.
I first opened my place, Angeli, back in 1984. We only had 24 seats, and people waited 2 hours to come in to eat pizza and panini. We hadn't even put pasta on the menu yet. And because it was so tiny, that thing of not requiring very many people to start a line happened. And it stayed that way for 6 months until we doubled in size. It was great, but I was always really aware that there were people outside waiting to come in. And so we tried to make sure that the Angeli experience started out in the line. We would always be passing slices of pizza, making sure kids had water. Have you talked to the owners about how they feel about the line and how they deal with it from a hospitality standpoint?
They actually say they feel a lot of pressure from the lines. There's a balance between keeping the quality of the food up and, you know, serving as many people as possible and, you know, turning really good quality food. Jessica Coslow-Squirrel, she actually works on the kitchen line on the weekends, and she says she can feel the pressure of the line, and she wants to make her customers happy. And she feels like the only way she can, you know, show that she values the time that they've waited is to put out high-quality food as quickly as possible. There's also this feeling of how these staff members and employees make the customers feel. They feel good. Like Johnny Zone, Helen Ray says he passes a chicken sandwich like it's baby Simba to them. And he gives out free pickles. He splits the staff shifts to maintain a level of energy with everyone. He, you know, he talks to them and, you know, compliments them. I also want to add how Victoria got a tattoo of a Howlin' Ray's chicken wing right at her elbow. And it's because of how the staff made her feel. And she got that a year ago.
That must be so powerful for a restaurant owner to realize that somebody has actually marked themselves with your food.
Yeah, she said when she told them, they were like, wow, you're crazy, but we love it, you know. And she has several other food tattoos, so that's not her first one.
What do you think the future is for these restaurants? Do you think they're resigned to dealing with the lines, with all of the good and bad they bring for the foreseeable future? Or are some of them trying to make some changes so the wait isn't quite so extreme?
It's inevitable that restaurants of this caliber are going to have to grow and change and expand and change the way they do business. As Johnny Zone of Helen Reyes has said, sometimes sequels and second restaurants can suck. You know, he's really conscientious of keeping the quality and culture up to his standards. You know, he himself expanded his Chinatown space so he can accommodate more customers on the week, you know, at night and on Tuesdays. And now they're working on a Culver City space next. But, you know, even with that, he's trying to build the same exact culture that he has in Chinatown. With Squirrel, they're opening a takeaway shop next door and doing an online ordering system. But, you know, Jessica said that she can't accommodate more guests to actually sit at the restaurant. She recently said in an Eater LA article that her plans for a West Side location fell through, but she's possibly going to look for a new location for that as well. And then for Ding Tai Fung, they're, since they're so old school, they've already, you know, opened practically a dozen locations along the West Coast. But what they've done is, you know, when they had their Arcadia location, their original one, it could only seat 60. Now their restaurants can seat 200 people. And they have a text message service where you can go shopping at the mall while you wait and you can just be alerted and come back. They also are hardcore with their efficiency, and every single person on staff has a special job they know ins and out of completely.
First of all, thank you for standing in all those lines.
My pleasure.
And it's just such a fascinating part of our culture here to learn a bit more about. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's Good Food contributor Jean Trin. We've been talking about the longest wait times in LA's restaurant scene. This piece was made possible by the Independent Producer Project. There's a fantastic new art installation in the Standard Hotel in downtown LA. It's a 2,800 square foot space that looks just like a grocery store, but all the groceries are made of felt. My conversation with the artist behind Sparrow Mart when Good Food returns. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Take the escalator up to the second floor of the Standard in downtown LA, and you'll find a grocery store stocked with everything on your list, from Brussels sprouts, Frosted Flakes, Tapatio tampons, to an old-school can of Tab, and even rat poison. British artist Lucy Sparrow has transformed the 2,800 square foot space into a virtual supermarket, stocked with over 30,000 handmade felt groceries. Of course, I had to go see it for myself. So, Lucy, Los Angeles is kind of known for this land of fantasy and enhancement, shall we say, and tons of different kinds of illusions. Is LA a perfect backdrop for your supermarket full of false but fun product?
It absolutely is. There was no doubt about the felt coming here for a huge installation. It's the perfect place. It's a wonderland of felt that people can visit and really lose themselves in, you know.
How many shops did you create before this one here in Los Angeles?
I've created four before. So this is number five. I did a corner shop in London. I did a gun shop in London. I did a sex shop in London, a bodega in New York. And then this is number five, Sparrow Mart.
So as I walk through the store, I mean, everybody's going to have products that they relate to because it's different levels of nostalgia and comfort. And the fact that everything is a plushie reinforces that kind of comforting familiarity. Did you have to do special research to figure out what brands would most resonate with people here?
Absolutely. I spent a lot of time going around supermarkets. I mean, hours just going around and photographing the shelves to the way that the shelves were put together, what shelves I was going to use, the arrangement of products, which ones go together, and specifically what products would be good to people living in Los Angeles.
So I have to ask you, as the daughter of a craft chick who learned needle arts very young, did you come to using felt just straight on, or did you sneak up to it by doing other kinds of textile work?
I've been making things out of felt since I was probably about six or seven. I remember my mum buying me some in the market when I was little, and I just got hooked ever since then, and I've never really stopped.
To give listeners an idea of the scale, how many objects did you bring here to Los Angeles to set up the market?
It was 31,000 of the felt pieces, and I guess that's not including the shop fittings. So there's shelves, fridges, fish counters, the checkout, which actually has a conveyor belt, so it's a lot.
The ATM machine.
Oh, yes, definitely the ATM machine, the meat counter, the gumball machine.
To me, this is the kind of art that everybody can embrace, because you can, like downstairs when I was there just now, you could see little girls running through and like picking out a box of Oreo or a thing of milk or some bologna. What have proved to be the most popular items?
The first item to be sold out was the Marichan instant lunch, these cup noodles. And we don't have them in England, but since getting here and working on the show, I've eaten a lot of them. And people just really loved them. I only made 30, so it obviously wasn't enough.
Yeah, I think you could have made 30,000 of those. Who helped you do this? Did you outsource the sewing to another country?
No, absolutely not. I have four people working in my studio, which I call the Felt Cave, and I have some outsourcing that I give to the ladies in the village to help me make multiples of everything, and then it comes back to the Felt Cave for me to paint, and I paint every single one.
You paint every single one yourself?
Yeah, I paint it all by hand, just freehand in batches. So I'll have like 40 soups to do. I'll then set out and paint them all in one go.
What music do you listen to while you're doing this?
Me and my assistant, Joe, are obsessed with true crime podcasts. So literally, we listen to them all day, every day. And it's quite funny when like couriers come and visit and they're just like, what are you listening to? Because sometimes it gets really dark.
There's a separate room that's a gallery that's different than the shop. And I noticed certain things that made me crazy. Like there was a little plate of fish and seafood. The mussels in particular had so much personality. Could you describe them and describe how you go about focusing on a subject and how you decide to anthropomorphize them, because so many things have faces.
I've always been into putting eyes on things that don't necessarily need eyes, and I think the things that work most for that is like the inanimate objects. Nothing I ever make has a nose. I always go for just eyes and a mouth. The mouth is quite expressionless, and it's always the eyes that speak, whether they're closer together or further apart. Each thing that has eyes has a different personality, just purely on the placement of things.
Ironically, this is art without any pretense, right? So it's open to everyone. It's totally relatable. How important is that for you, the accessibility, for anyone to walk through the store and be able to smile and enjoy and want to have something?
It's hugely important. I remember when I was first starting out in art, and I knew that I wanted to be an artist from literally as long as I could remember. And I used to be really into photography, and that was sort of like the first thing that I tried to do as an artist. And I remember going around galleries in my hometown and almost being laughed out the front door just because of sheer, how dare you approach us with like cold calling with your work. And I felt so crushed by that. I made it my mission just to be like, no one should ever be shamed from like their background, their inexperience, from going to see any kind of art show or wanting to get into it. That's the best thing about art. Anyone can do it from any background, financial, race, gender, whatever. You can do anything.
Throughout our conversation, you've been cradling a plushy banana, and his name is Basil, Basil the banana. How old were you when you made your first plushie that you used to comfort yourself?
I think I was probably 7. I didn't make Basil. He's a fairground toy, but he's my absolute buddy. He goes everywhere with me. But my first felt thing I made, probably about 7. I used to take them all into bed with me.
And when did you start concentrating on recreating food and packaging?
Actually, one of the first things I made, I made a few things before that, like Christmas decorations for my mum, but I remember making a fried breakfast. And I guess I was like 7 or 8 because I was living in the first house that I lived in. So yeah, it was a fried egg, sausages, tomatoes. And I just remember being like enthralled that you could make anything that you wanted. It was all possible.
I love that you exist. No, seriously, it's such a wonderful piece. It's huge. The scale of it is huge, but it's so wonderful to watch people walk through it giggling. It must be such a wonderful feeling for you to watch people kind of insert themselves into the piece.
The interaction is what finalizes, puts the final touches on the artwork. You know, I was working on this for a year, and you hide yourself away in the studio and you barely have any contact with anyone. And then all of a sudden, for maybe a month, you have all these people and you realize that all those times where you were like thinking, oh, is it worth it? It's so much work. And then it's like, yes, it definitely was. I like to hide in the aisles and so no one can sort of see me and I listen to what people are saying.
What's the city after us, after LA?
I don't know the city, but I think the plan is to go to China.
They're going
to
go crazy.
I haven't been. I went to Beijing on a stopover on a flight to Tokyo, and yeah, so I haven't been properly ever. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you so much, Lucy.
My pleasure.
That's artist Lucy Sparrow. Visit the Sparrow Mart through the month of August or until they sell out at the Standard Downtown LA. It's closed on Mondays and open the rest of the week from 11 till 9. Now for a trip to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Laura Avery's there with a new report.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm at the market today having a chat with chef owner Juan Pablo Torre of Bar Garcia, which is located in downtown LA in the Fashion District. Juan, you are Argentinian by birth, by origin. Tell us what you're looking for an ingredient and what you're going to be preparing.
Today I came to the farmer's market to buy okra. And what I'm looking at is to find the baby ones where the time of cooking is short and you can keep all the vitamins, all the nutrients, especially magnesium.
So when you say small okra, I mean, I guess it can get up to about 6 inches, but you say a small is about 3 inches,
yeah,
maybe?
Yeah, no more than 3. Uh-huh. And that is those ones are tenderer. Mm-hmm. And normally the one are 6 inches or 5 inches. Can be a little bit rubbery inside when you cook it, and it's not really pleasant. And with the baby ones, you can eat everything.
They have seeds, they have that little cap. You leave that little cap on top?
Yeah, if they are the baby, mm-hmm. you leave the cap on top. Mm-hmm. If they are the big ones, not.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about that slime, for lack of a better word. It's kind of a slimy when it cooks, but it's delicious. What is that, and do you like it or not?
I actually love it. actually is part, but as less you cook it, less you have that. That is the important why I'm looking at for the small ones. Mm-hmm. And that's it. After we like to cook, you know, our dish at the restaurant where it's a combination between soca, guacamole, and salted okra with a Dacian touch.
What is soca?
Soca is a traditional dish from south of France and north of Europe, where normally you can find as a, like in the farmer's market, like here. And it's a really simple, like a street food. Like it's a chickpea flour with water and salt. At Bar Garcia, we make it really thin on the oven, like a really hot pizza oven. And then it's only 1 minute to the process to be cooked. It's a really simple dish. The okra is another process where we deep fry for less than 1 minute. And we add that soya and orange sauce. It's an orange reduction, but with the skin, with everything, we mix it up with the okra, and then we add Thai basil and chili, and Thai chili.
Okay, and then you add guacamole to that.
Yeah, the guacamole is just the avocado, lime, chili, cilantro, and a little bit of onion.
Are they side by side on the soca, or are they like all mixed together on top of the soca?
It's soca in one side, okra in the other one, and guacamole in the middle.
Okay. And then you mix as you see fit.
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Vegan option.
Vegan option, yeah. Okay, well, that sounds delicious and amazing, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was chef owner Juan Pablo Torre at Bar Garcia downtown in the Fashion District. And he is experimenting with cross-cultural combinations, inspired, of course, here at the Farmer's Market. I'm talking now with farmer Luis Jaime from San Bernardino County, who's growing that okra that Juan was talking about. And so you have a beautiful, beautiful display of okra today on your table. How long have you had it? How long does it take to grow? What's the program?
It's about 4 months from we seed it until we get the first crops. Usually when we start, we get about 10 pounds, 20 pounds, which never make it to the table.
Yeah.
You know, but now we have enough for the table.
And it'll keep increasing in production as you can pick more and more?
That's correct. Now we're starting to pick it twice a week, and we get about 20 cases per pick. So we usually pick 20 on Monday and then 20 on Thursday.
Okay, and how many acres or rows do you have of okra right now?
We usually do 20 rows of 200 feet green and 20 rows of the red, but this year we end up with 40 rows of green okra.
You had 40 rows of green. Why was that?
We messed up the seeds when we sent out the bags. They look exactly the same. So,
how do you plant it? Do you put the seed in the ground?
Before we used to do it by hand, but it was just taking too long. So now what we do, even though we waste a little bit of seed with a little seeder, so we do the 40 rows within, I don't know, an hour or so.
Oh, you do. So you plant all 40 rows at once. You don't plant one and then wait a month. Oh, okay.
No, otherwise, because it takes so long. And then when it starts producing, they don't come out like huge amounts. But usually we do like one okra per plant when it starts. And then once it's like full production, we get about 4 or 5 okras per plant.
But they keep producing more and more.
More and more.
Okay.
And until we get the first frost, which is in end of November. So we will go from July, for sure, October, maybe a week or two of November.
Okay, and then the frost just kind of knocks it down, and then you're done. Yeah. Do you try to pick the same size okra every week?
We do, but some of them grow faster than the others, so that's why we end up with different sizes.
Okay, and you just throw them all in together?
All everything together.
But it's the same price, no matter what size?
I know some restaurants would want to separate it. You're welcome to do it yourself. We're not going to do it. Yeah, we're not going to.
Right.
Because it takes a long time to pick it, and then to be separating it, it's too much.
So is it popular? Do people like okra?
Now, it is more popular. It's picking up. Like, you go to restaurants, and then you see it, like, pickle. Even in your plate, you don't even know it's okra. Mm. And a lot of people, they eat it and they don't even know what it is. You know?
Do you eat okra? Do you
Oh, no, we make a special, every time we go out there, we make a side dish. We just cut it, slice it with jalapenos, tomato, garlic, and onion, saute it, and that's our side dish.
When you're up at picking for the day?
For the day.
Yeah. Okay, so you're going to have it all the way till frost, maybe not quite till Thanksgiving, though.
I think 1 year we did. But we're like Mother Nature, whatever she says.
I know. So next year we'll look for the red okra then.
Next year.
Yeah, this year.
Okay.
We missed it up.
All right, well, thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you.
That was Luis Jaime from JF Organic. By the way, it is organic okra. JF Organic Farm from San Bernardino County. It's a four-month crop to grow, and so enjoy it. It'll be here all the way through October, maybe into November. Hopefully, he says. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Finally, we close with the late Jonathan Gold. Over the past few weeks, we've been remembering him in his own words. Mona Holmes, a reporter for Eater, and she's here to talk to me about her favorite Jonathan Gold piece from his days as a music critic in the 1980s. A lot of people don't know that Jonathan was a music critic way back in the day in the 80s and that he covered various genres of music, including then LA's emerging hip-hop scene. And of course, one of the biggest acts he covered was NWA. Tell me about the article that you focused on and how you found out about it.
Back in 2007, I read his piece on NWA for the first time, even though it was written in 1989. A friend of mine said, hey, have you ever checked this out? And at the time, I was also a music journalist. So I immediately thought, oh, well, I have to check this out. And I was blown away by it then, but I was also blown away by it revisiting it just a few weeks ago by how detailed and how he went on such a deep dive about this band that was still emerging but not yet in superstar status, about to be in superstar status. And the guy who did it was Jonathan Gold, but he was the perfect, in my opinion, the perfect journalist to do that job.
Why do you say that?
Because NWA is as LA as it gets, and so was Jonathan. And so he was able to bring out certain details. I mean, he completely drew a map in this long-form piece from the band opening up for Ice-T, who's also an LA artist, and even though he was the headliner, Jonathan mentioned how the audience knew more of the lyrics for NWA's lyrics over Ice-T's. In the article, he also mentions how there was a beef going on between two gangs and NWA was mentioned in it, but Jonathan Gold actually mentions the names of the gangs in the piece. There's a very LA aspect of it that I think that no other reporter could have ever done. He brought out the LA-ness of the band, and for the LA Weekly, I thought it was just incredible the way that he did it.
As a person who's been so used to communicating with Jonathan over the years about food and, you know, used to the language that he used and the sort of cadence he used describing food, to read a piece like this and listen to the vocabulary he used for describing the music is extraordinary. I mean, more and more I just feel like Mr. Gold is like peeling an onion.
Yeah, it's insane the way he does it. I mean, he even... Back to the musical points, he mentions staccato and a quarter beat, and in referring to it to a band in a genre that wasn't really developed yet. I mean, they didn't call themselves gangster rappers, but they certainly defined it. He was able to really recognize what they really were. He even, in the piece, calls their music quite beautiful. In 1989, Jonathan Gold says this, so...
He takes his music history, music criticism hat, and just filters it through all that knowledge. Could you do me a favor and read an excerpt?
Absolutely, Evan. Straight Outta Compton, the title track from NWA's first album, is violent before anyone says a word. A strong backbeat overlaid by a nervous repeating snare fill that palpitates like coffee jitters, like a sick feeling in the pit of your stomach, like an itchy trigger finger. The beat is scary all by itself in this song. Too intimidating to dance to, really. Not an in-your-face sort of deal like Public Enemy or Big Daddy Kane, but somehow ruthless, quietly intense. Under this, a single quarter note repeats, plucked on an electric guitar, and a thick, long note, roughly sampled tenor saxophones. So give it up, spoon. Ain't no telling when I'm down for a jack move. Here's a mother rack to keep you dancing. It sounds like is deliberately underblown and brought up to a sour, wavering pitch, as if on a tape machine low on batteries. The sound fabric breathes, creepily alive. Faint cries can be heard in the background on the offbeats of 3 and 4, as on Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock's It Takes Two, although they seem less cries of passion here than distant cries for help. An AK-47 shudders, and horrified, you can sense the beauty in this sound.
You know, it's so interesting that he uses a little bit of food imagery in the music, just as later he would use music imagery to describe food.
100%.
So I understand that Jonathan was one of the reasons you got into food writing.
When I was working at KPCC way back when, I asked Larry Mantle if we could do a piece and invite Jonathan Golden. And I, like everyone else at that time, picked up a physical copy of the LA Weekly to read Counterintelligence. And I remember when I was working in the Border Grill in Santa Monica and making that very long trek from Pasadena to Santa Monica in rush hour and listening to the interview before I started my shift. And Jonathan was such, I loved hearing his voice, and Larry Mantle had such a good time with that segment. Sure, that definitely made me realize, okay, that's really cool. You know, and he would ask little questions here and there, like about what I was doing. And
he followed up with you?
No, I would see him because I worked at Ciudad and at Border Grill in Santa Monica. And so I would see him and say, how's it going? And, you know, and he was a friendly guy. So he would ask questions about what I was up to. And I didn't believe that I could make a living as a food writer. I remember someone telling me that I just could never do it and I would never make any money and that it would be all awful and poverty from beginning to end. But it doesn't really matter when that's your passion. But I also loved how he opened up and inspired me to look at neighborhoods that were different from mine and to really get into the nitty-gritty details of food writing that make all the difference. The influence is strong with Jonathan.
That's Mona Holmes, reporter for Eater. We've been talking about the late Jonathan Gold's 1989 cover story for the LA Weekly about NWA. That is it for our show this week. If you missed any part of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. If you dug the show, leave us a review. We always love hearing from you. Many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Nick Liao, Rosalie Atkinson, Laurel Garcia, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food. Yeah.